This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks.
By 1969, it really did feel like we were finally winning some kind of cultural war against the establishment.
Young people were rejecting the status quo. The one thing that affected everybody was the war in Vietnam.
I knew a lot of people who just felt, we have to do things differently.
We were looking for answers. We were looking for other people that felt the same way as we did.
It's been 50 years since the word Woodstock became part of America's cultural vernacular. A large field in upstate New York attracted hundreds of thousands of people for a three-day event focused on peace, love, and music. But it almost didn't happen. And when it did, it was riddled with problems. The PBS series American Experience is currently airing and streaming the documentary Woodstock, which takes the camera away from the famous musicians and turns it towards the experience of the young people who showed up for the party. I spoke earlier with producer Jamila Efron. Jamila Efron, thanks so much for taking some time to talk to us today.
Thanks for having me.
So the film is called Woodstock, 3 days that defined a generation. How did this event do that? How did it define a generation?
Well, we realized that you can't tell the story of Woodstock without talking about the cultural moment that it sprang out of. And that was a decade that was defined by assassinations of leaders, the Kennedys, the Kennedy brothers, and Martin Luther King, the draft. There was a cultural revolution. There was a sexual revolution. The things were very fraught. There was a feeling of pervasive political alienation amongst young people, a feeling that the older generation had kind of forsaken the younger. And so this moment, this weekend, the reason why I think it resonates with these people who were there so much and with people who weren't there so much is that it was a time that they were able to overcome adversity and come together and live by the values that they thought were possible, that they believed the world should be lived by. And they were able to actually pull it off and do it that weekend. So for them, it was a defining moment.
They were definitely challenged. And that's what I found so fascinating about the documentary that you produced. What a logistical nightmare this was. I mean, we have a segment here on the show that we lose every now and then. We freak out over filling 15 minutes. The producers of Woodstock, a three-day festival where hundreds of thousands of people were coming, lost its location, had to fight with another community in order to put it on. They lost their food vendors. At one point, they ran out of food. But I'm wondering, because we got to see how all these folks came together, as you mentioned, and I wonder, what would this period in American history be like had Woodstock not happened?
Well, that's a great question. I'm hard to answer. I think that this was a moment when the values of the counterculture generation that they were trumpeting, they were actually able to put those values to the test and come out saying, this is how you do it. This is how you come together during adversity and you take care of each other. And all parties kind of were the best versions of themselves, from the local community to the organizers who were thinking really carefully about how to keep these people safe and entertained and communicated with, informed about what was going on outside. And the people in the crowd who were able to overcome the discomfort, if there was hunger, the hunger, the overcrowding, the terrible weather conditions, and be generous with each other. They believed that this is how you could live. And that weekend, they actually were able to. So, I don't know of what it would be like without it, but I imagine that, they'd still be wondering if such a thing were possible.
I thought it was also really interesting to learn that Woodstock itself, the festival, was a financial disaster for the investors. They ended up making it free to attend because they couldn't get all the fencing up in time. But there was this benevolence, there was this love, there was this grooviness, as they say throughout the documentary, among the huge crowd. And I'm wondering, what did you take away from this exploration of this music and love fest that was taking place in 1969 amid a backdrop of Vietnam and the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy?
I mean, for me, it's a story about everyone kind of overcoming their own agendas for the sake of the greater good. I mean, the funders of the festival, John Roberts and Joel Rosenman, who came together with these guys from a totally different walk of life from the Mike Lang and Artie Kornfeld, their interests were purely capitalist. They wanted to make money. That's why they did this. And when push came to shove, they realized that money wasn't the most important thing. The most important thing was actually keeping all these people who had turned up safe and putting a show on. And so they did the right thing, and they sacrificed everything. I mean, to keep the show going, they had to write a lot of bad checks that they knew they could no longer cover because things had gotten so out of control when they had to move sites. And, you know, John Roberts was prepared to go to jail for that. But he just knew he had to keep the show going. That to me is just the story of sort of putting your money aside and your own self-interest aside for the sake of a greater good was one of the most powerful things I took away from the festival. And the sort of the fact that this was a time of hopelessness for a lot of these people. I mean, the counterculture believed that a new world was possible, but they didn't know. And this, this was a weekend when they were able to sort of prevail over any hopelessness and fear that they had and come together. I think that's sort of an evergreen message that now I think you could certainly say that young people feel a similar sense of alienation and fear about the future with concerns about climate change and political alienation. And, I don't know how this generation is going to actually kind of overcome that and prevail over those fears, but can certainly look to what happened in 1969 as a lesson in when it's happened before.
This wasn't the first music festival. I noticed in your piece, your documentary, that the organizers, when trying to figure out smaller logistic things that you might overlook if you're just thinking broadly, but how many toilets do we need? How much food should we plan to have? They went and visited other festivals. So other things were happening across the country that brought huge crowds in. Why do we remember Woodstock?
I think we remember Woodstock because it, first of all, the lineup was incredible, but also because of what happened in the audience, because it was on a knife's edge and it sort of ended up being okay, because it was this incredible coming together of 500,000 people from, the communities who took care of these kids and fed them, to the organizers, to the musicians who sort of were themselves completely shocked and awed by the crowd, to the people who in the crowd who, they had to become, it was challenging for them. They had to sort of put their fears and paranoia aside and discomfort and just get through it and take care of each other. And so it taught these kids something about themselves. And when something like that happens on such a scale, I think, it profoundly shifts you. A lot of the people we spoke to, they kind of stopped going to college. These weren't just hippies. They were a lot of just regular college kids, high school kids. And many of them described kind of leaving Woodstock and dropping out of college and going to do some kind of active service for a few years before going back. It shifted their paradigms profoundly.
We've talked about the logistics challenges of putting Woodstock on. I'm curious about your logistics. American Experience is such an important series. I'm a huge fanboy of American Experience, but it looks like each episode or film takes ages to produce. I'm wondering if you'd be kind enough to just kind of give us the Cliff's Notes version of what goes into creating one of these things.
Well, it's different for each topic you have. This was a bit different because we decided not to film any original interviews on camera. We just used audio recordings. And what was unique about that experience was it was a bit of a leap of faith. We knew that Warner Brothers had hours upon hours of outtakes from the original 1971 film that they had not used. But we'd heard sort of rumors that they had been damaged in a flood. We didn't know how long it would take us to actually come to an agreement with Warner Brothers. And when the footage came in, what condition it would be in. So, you know, we proceeded in gathering these audio interviews long before we actually had the footage in. So that the challenge was figuring out how we were going to create a visual component for this film. So that was the longest part of it, was getting these materials in and then making some sense of them. Of course, when they finally did come in, they were gorgeous, although they came in out of order, upside down. Our editor had to spend a lot of time kind of piecing together the footage and figuring out from like the ground, was it muddy or not, when the shot was from, because nothing was sort of logged or cataloged, and it all came in silent without sound. So it was an enormous undertaking to do a sound mix. Our incredible sound designer basically had to create a soundscape from scratch. The challenges from this film are very different from when we make a film where we're shooting interviews. Usually we have a long research period, which we did for this one. Casting was very long for this one because we had so many hundreds of thousands of possible people to include in the film. And then just waiting on the visuals to come in. So it was a different experience.
I was curious about where those visuals came from, because I know, of course, there was the famous documentary Woodstock, the original one in 1970, that showed mostly the musical acts. So that is where a lot of this footage came from, was just the stuff they didn't use then?
Yeah. You know, Warner Brothers sort of was very tight-fisted about this. They knew how valuable their footage was, and so they had been reluctant to share it with anybody, certainly the outtakes they'd never shared. And so we were able to, you know, persuade them that this project was the one to sort of give them over to. We owe an incredible debt of gratitude to the original filmmaking team. We also got some news footage. There were eventually some news crews at the site, and then a lot of home movie footage. A lot of the attendees had been filming with their Super 8 cameras, so we were able to sort of cobble together a film out of that.
The pictures are really great. They're, you know, you're seeing stuff for the first time, as you mentioned. And I mean, just really cool, intimate moments. I think my favorite part where I was really moved was when the festival had run out of food and the town comes to their aid after kind of being iffy on whether this event should take place in their community. When they got word that these kids at this concert were out of food, they all came together and found as much food in the community as they could to ship over. And then you have the audience. There's a great shot of members in one row passing a can of what looks like SpaghettiOs and dipping their fingers directly in it and eating it. I mean, this stuff was really fascinating.
Yeah, I think we could do a super cut of all the eating done in Woodstock.
And the other interesting thing about the original documentary, Woodstock, was that was a huge financial success. So after losing money on the festival itself, it was the documentary that came out that kind of saved these investors.
Yeah, that also could be a film unto itself. They were able to sell the footage to Warner Brothers, not for nearly as much as it ended up making, but enough to make them whole. You know, they certainly didn't profit in the way that Warner Brothers has. I think that's one of the best grossing films for them of all time. But it was just enough to kind of make them okay again.
The movie grossed $50 million at the box office. And the director of this particular installment of American Experience, who you work with at ARC Media, Barack Goodman, you all have worked on other projects, Clinton, about President Clinton, which, like I said, I had just watched for a second time because it's really great. I'm wondering what else is in the pipeline for us to check out soon from you all.
We are working on a biography of President George W. Bush for American Experience. That is going to be out next spring. We have Barrick, actually, we're here at the Traverse City Film Festival. Barrick's here with Woodstock, which we're going to be screening shortly, but he also has another film here on gerrymandering called Slay the Dragon, which I believe will be coming out in theaters next year as well. So it's a big year for us at ARC Media.
Looking forward to that. And I read that the President George W. Bush one is going to be a two-parter as well.
Yep, 4 hours.
Awesome. Well, the movie is called Woodstock. It's part of American Experience. It is available on the PBS streaming app now. Jamila Efron, so appreciative of you taking some time to talk to us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And the music of Woodstock lives on in a couple of weeks with a free concert at Washington Park and over the Rhine. And no, it won't feature those iconic acts from 1969, but instead, young musicians from the Mason School of Rock. And joining Cincinnati Edition now, our School of Rock owner, Tim Gary. Welcome, Tim.
Thank you. Thank you for having us on.
Guitar instructor, Stephen Kuttner. Welcome, Stephen.
Kuffner. Good to be here.
Thank you. I have two T's in there. It's Kuffner. My apologies, Stephen Kuffner.
No worries.
Vocal student, Kathy Black is here.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And guitar student, Logan Flum.
Yes.
All right, Flum. You. Welcome. Glad to see you all. Okay. So, Tim, tell us about why you wanted to teach these kids about Woodstock.
Well, we've been talking about doing a Woodstock show for years. The lineup of bands in that show was just amazing. And, in fact, we've done shows with several of the bands that have been focused on several of the different bands, but decided to wait to the 50th anniversary to bring it all together. It's actually a really big deal for us. We have what we call a show, which is a group of students who are going to perform a show. And we actually have three different groups that are coming together, to do this show. Two of our youth groups, are doing Woodstock, and then our adult program is actually working on a Who show that they'll be doing in October, and they will do a Who set as part of the Woodstock performance that we're doing in Washington Park.
And Stephen, when you're teaching guitar, is there anything unique about teaching the sound of that era?
Oh, that's actually a great question. I mean, there's so many different styles. So you have like Sly and the Family Stone, like real funky. You've got Jimi Hendrix with the crazy solos and improvisation. So it really goes from, you know, artist to artist. You had to kind of find the right student for each song and kind of cast it out that way. So a lot of great educational opportunities, like as Tim said, across the board, most definitely.
You know, I'm not even old enough to know Woodstock, and these two kids aren't even half my age. So Logan, tell me what you thought about exploring the sound from 1969.
Oh, I've loved this music for a while. I guess it's...
Well, was there anything challenging about it?
There's so many different bands that we're playing. There's a lot of style differences in them, and it's very interesting to go through all of those bands and learn all of those new styles and put them together. And
any song that became your favorite that maybe you weren't familiar with intimately?
Honestly, I was actually very in tune with this music, and I loved it. I've loved it for a while. I guess I love playing Hey Joe by Jimi Hendrix. That's
all right.
Fun.
Cool. And Kathy, you're a vocal student, so I imagine you will be singing?
Yes, I will be.
All right. What songs are you going to be belting out?
I'm going to be singing Try by Janis Joplin, No Expectations by Joan Baez, and Stand by Sly and the Family Stone.
Were you familiar with Woodstock at all?
I was familiar with a couple of the artists. I was really familiar with Janis Joplin, which is really why I joined the show. But I was really interested in learning more about the other artists that were a part of Woodstock because it's such a big part of American history. So I really wanted to learn more about what made the whole Woodstock itself.
How, Tim and Stephen, did you all go about putting the program together? Like, how did you decide which songs would be appropriate or worth exploring?
Sure. Great question again. So really, it came down to finding the right opportunities for our students. And it's about having the right balance between kind of representing the spirit of Woodstock, making sure that we're crossing off all the major artists who are a part of that event, and then gathering our cast amongst, I think we're going to have over 60 performers. As Tim said, there's two groups of like younger students and then the adult group as well. So it's really about finding the song that's going to be challenging and inspiring for that student, but that they can also kind of realistically achieve over the course of the several months that we have to prepare all the material.
And Tim, tell us about what the School of Rock in Mason is.
So we are actually one of over 200 schools of rock around the world. We opened up 7 years ago. We teach guitar, bass, drums, keyboards, and vocals, all in private lessons. But what really distinguishes us is our focus on performance. So about two-thirds of our students are involved in our performance programs where we're putting on concerts every 4 months. For this season, we've decided to focus on music festivals, so we're putting on the Woodstock show, and then we are also putting on shows based around Lollapalooza, the Warped Tour, and Rock on the Range, so very different kinds of music festivals. And as I said, our adult program is putting on a Who show as well. We've put on over 100 shows since we've opened, 100 different shows. It's a wonderful experience. We find that kids who get involved or adults who get involved in performance tend to become much more engaged in learning about music and tend to learn much faster because they're going to be on stage in 4 months. And so it's a wonderful thing to do. And also playing in a band is completely different than playing in your room, you know, to your stereo. So it's a great social experience as well as very challenging musically.
Has that been your experience, Logan? Is that getting out of the room and playing with a group of people has been beneficial?
Yeah, definitely. I started guitar before I ended up going to School of Rock, and there's a very definitely noticeable difference in how much I was interested in music when I actually came to School of Rock.
And Kathy, what song are you looking most forward to singing?
I'm looking forward to singing Try by Janis Joplin.
Why?
Her sound has been just so interesting and fun to play with and, you know, make my own. And she's just such a powerful singer that it's been really fun to try and emulate that myself.
And Stephen, what's been most interesting of watching these young people learn the music from Woodstock?
I think Kathy just said it herself perfectly. They make it their own. And it's really great to see how engaging or engaged the students are in this material, how much it matters to them and to each other to put on a really amazing performance. It's incredibly rewarding as a teacher to just see these incredible students just giving it their best all the time and really bringing the best out of each other. It's really cool.
School of Rock Mason celebration of Woodstock's 50th anniversary is this Sunday, August 25th, and that will be at Washington Park. And it starts at 6 o'clock.
Starts at 6 o'clock.
And it's free.
And it's free.
Awesome. My thanks to all of you, Tim, Gary, Stephen Kuffner, Kathy Black, and Logan Flum. Thanks for coming in and chatting with us.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. The Transcontinental Railroad was completed a century and a half ago, permanently altering the country's economic, cultural, and political identity. And for years, the experience of the Chinese workers who made it possible was largely ignored. An exhibit at the downtown library seeks to change that. Plus, the lives of African American men like Muhammad Ali, W.E.B. Du Bois, and Kendrick Lamar are part of the latest offering at the Freedom Center. Men of Change, tomorrow at noon on Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.